Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of vanityfair.com, and I'm here with our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
Our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And in our New York studio, we have our Hollywood correspondent in from Los Angeles, Rebecca Keegan.
Hello.
Rebecca, you're in New York not just for the spring weather, which I understand has not really cooperated.
Yeah, you guys, this is not spring. I regret to inform you.
But there's a lot of nice flowering trees.
Yes, to remind you of what
of
it's supposed to be like.
What it should be like, yes.
You're in town for the Tribeca Film Festival. You're going to be a juror. So we're going to talk a little bit later about the experience of being on a film festival jury and what you can kind of learn from that. But first, there's another huge festival on the horizon. Cannes is in less than a month, and there has been a ton of news about it in the last week as the battle between Cannes and Netflix that started about a year ago, really reached a full boil. Rebecca, you were reporting on this last week. Does this boil down to a battle between two really important guys who don't want to give an inch? What caused things with Netflix and Cannes to get so intense?
Well, they started really poorly last year when, I mean, I think Richard and I were both sitting in the Netflix screening of Okja where the projector broke. They started projecting
frame.
It in the wrong format or something. Which
people were booing and hissing. I had no idea. And everyone's like, well, you can see part of the movie at the top of
Tilda Swinton's head was cut off. But it seemed like a giant sort of FU from Cannes to Netflix at their the streaming company's first time at the festival.
So we think that they intentionally had the projector off the screen?
That was implied by
That's
many
amazing.
People.
Wow.
You know, there had been
sabotage. What's the French word for sabotage?
Saboteur, yeah.
Sounds like.
And, you know, critics were booing the Netflix logo. Meanwhile, you know, Netflix had spent obviously an extraordinary amount of money to be there. They had this big glamorous villa, and they were really excited. And I think that they did not have a great experience at Cannes.
To go back a little bit, why is it that critics were so primed to be anti-Netflix at this point last year? Because there had already been some scuffle between Netflix and Cannes by then.
Right. Well, Netflix's distribution model obviously is not inclined toward theatrical releases, and a lot of critics are bothered by that. In France, of course, they have this very long window that they demand for theatrical release. 3 years after a movie's in theaters, it can go on a streaming service. Netflix doesn't play that way. And Cannes had decided that Netflix movies going forward, that any movie that doesn't have a theatrical release in France would not be able to play in competition.
So any movie that shows at Cannes this year is not going to be streamable for 3 years?
Any competition movie. So, for instance, like the Han Solo movies playing out of competition.
Okay.
That won't affect them.
But any movie in France that has a theatrical run has to wait 36 months before it can go on a streaming service. It's
in
less,
France?
Yeah,
or
in France.
Okay,
France.
So we can watch it on Netflix
We're fine.
Here.
We're fine. It's okay. Just like, but correct me if I'm wrong, Rebecca, the problem is that Netflix would not budge off this day and date thing. Even in France, it would be illegal for a movie to be in a theater and on a streaming service at the same time, essentially, in France. And so the festival said, well, then you can come to the festival, but you can't be in competition because competition films have to screen in theaters in France. They have to be theatrical releases.
And didn't the director say, like, just do it with one. Just pick one movie. And we know the rule's kind of ridiculous, and we hope they change it, but this is the rule, right? I mean, he seemed to be, was that like kind of weird?
You mean Terry Fermeau?
Yeah.
Well, there were a few movies that seemed to have been affected, and one of them is this Orson Welles movie that has been, you know, was shot in the 1970s and was just finished, and it obviously was never going to premiere in competition. So at one point, you know, Terry Fermeau was saying, just let the Orson Welles movie come and play out of competition. I think, really, you know, the arrogance of Netflix and the arrogance of the Cannes Film Festival are pretty much equal. So you had this game of chicken going up right until the lineup announcement. And really, I think, you know, the people who lost are those of us going to Cannes, because there are several movies that Netflix had intended to bring, including the new Alfonso Cuarón movie, that are now not going.
But you'll be able to watch them on Netflix that night in your hotel room.
Theoretically, yeah, okay. Or soon.
Yeah, so what else was Netflix planning to bring that now won't premiere until presumably Telluride or Toronto?
Good question. It's a lot of it flown out of my brain. I have to quickly Google my own story. Because...
Oh, I have your story.
Okay.
So Alfonso Cuarón's movie, which I believe is supposed to be like a small-scale Mexican family drama. Paul Greengrass's Norway, which is about the horrific shooting that happened in Norway about 8 years ago. Jeremy Saulnier's Hold the Dark, which I actually don't know that much about. And then the Orson Welles movie that you mentioned, Rebecca. And then a documentary from Morgan Neville, who also has a Mr. Rogers documentary out this year, which is fascinating. But he has a documentary about Orson Welles, which I guess goes hand-in-hand with that unfinished release.
I have to say, I'm kind of relieved that the Paul Greengrass movie won't be there, because
so you don't have to watch it.
That. Like, Katie, you and I talked about this a little on Twitter.
When, we did.
That when I sort of realized that movie existed, but like, I'm sure it'll be well made, but oof, that's tough stuff.
It's hard to get excited about a movie about violence for me right now. I mean, thinking about the Lars von Trier movie, which is apparently very violent, which was announced that will be coming to Cannes despite
out of competition, interestingly.
Out of competition, and despite the filmmaker's very sort of problematic history at the festival and just in general. Both of these movies seem like they're pretty dark and pretty violent, and it's like, gosh, we got a lot of that going on in the real world. Tough to want to buckle up in a movie theater for it, I think.
Yeah, and I don't know how you felt last year, Rebecca, at the festival, but I was pretty, like, depressed by a lot of the selection last year. Like, it was some dark stuff. It was the Yorgos Lanthimos movie and Michael Haneke, and it was just like, ugh, like, the world is terrible enough.
Right.
Like, but it doesn't seem like Cannes has tried to make any sort of, like, they're not trying to cheer us up this year.
No.
Yeah.
I think they figure Sun in Rosé balance everything going on in the screening.
If you didn't get the message last year and fix the world, then what can they do? They have to double down.
So we have the lineup now, and Richard, I remember you saying, like, I think the consensus is that it's pretty low on movie stars, which can be tricky for coverage for some people, but are there bright spots in there? Does it look a little less depressing?
You know, I'm really curious to see the Spike Lee movie, Black Klansman, which is based on a true story, which I think is not something he's done a lot of before in his film work. I don't like a lot of the movies that Spike Lee has made in the last, I don't know, roughly 20 years. You know, he's made interesting stuff like Chirac, but and I know that he likes Cannes a lot, so I don't know, I just think it's going to be an interesting combination of things, especially given what's going on in this country and the way that France sort of reflects that in weird ways and doesn't in others, and I think that could be good. And then, you know, the Under the Silver Lake, which is the other kind of big American title in the competition from the director of It Follows, there's already a trailer out for that, Andrew Garfield's in it. It doesn't look Oscar-y or anything like that, but it certainly looks interesting. Although it does kind of feel like more of a Sundance movie in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It Follows was also at Cannes, so I guess there's precedent there.
Yeah, the Black Klansman, I had lunch recently with the producer of that, who also produced Get Out, and he feels really strongly that that's Spike's best movie in about 20 years. He said, you know, the movie you've been waiting for him to make for a really long time, this is it. And it's a really interesting true story about this African-American man who goes undercover in the Klan. It's really hard to understand, but apparently this actually happened, and people seem to think that Spike is back.
And it stars John David Washington, who is Denzel Washington's son, and was also in several movies at Sundance, and is kind of like having a moment right now. And so that's interesting too. And yeah, so I don't know. I think there's reason to be excited about it. But past those two titles, you know, cynically for our purposes, it's a lot of foreign stuff with a lot of famous people in them. But that doesn't mean they're not good. And I don't think, you know, I think a lot of the, when the lineup was initially announced, there was a lot of sort of disappointment or like, you know, like, oh, what are we going to do? But that shouldn't detract from the actual quality of the movies, you know.
Fun fact about both of these American titles, Topher Grace is in both of them.
Topher Grace is the Nicole Kidman of Cannes 2018.
I can't
Who
wait to
thought?
See what he wears on the red carpet.
I can't
really
either.
Brought it last year.
Yes. Thank God the jury, though, is super starry.
Yes.
Right? We got Kay Stu, Ava DuVernay, Kate Blanchett's the president of the jury. So we'll
Leah Seydoux, Denis Villeneuve. Like, it's really, it's quite a lineup on the jury. So we'll get good red carpets.
That's right.
Well, yeah, they go to every red carpet event. So as the person who'll be curating our Cannes red carpet slideshow, I'm very grateful to Kristen Stewart and Kate Blanchett.
Good stuff is coming.
I wanted to go back to Netflix for a second because a big part of Netflix's gambit has been, you know, we have all the money in the world. We can bring your films to this huge audience. But I think as Noah Baumbach was kind of indicating with Meyerowitz Stories, like you're getting thrown into the Netflix machine. It feels like this Cannes thing is a really big blow to their effort to try to draw auteurs like that. Like Alfonso Cuarón really can get his movies made anywhere. Why would he try to go to Netflix again if he's going to be denied this huge platform? Do you get that sense, Rebecca?
Well, I think, you know, Cannes is fighting its own sort of battle for staying relevant. So ultimately, I actually think Cannes is hurt more by this than Netflix. I mean, Netflix will just go to Venice or Telluride or Toronto with its movies. Definitely, Netflix has trouble with this issue of convincing auteurs that, you know, it's going to give them a proper theatrical release and marketing campaign. But I think in this case, sort of, Cannes comes out with a worse black eye. They may not realize it now, but with a worse black eye. I mean, this and, you know, sort of the banning of selfies and these other things that just sort of seem to suggest that they're getting less and less relevant. I think, you know, Alfonso Cuarón makes a new movie. It will end up premiering at a fabulous festival, just not this one.
I'm kind of curious about the psychology of Ted Sarandos here because, you know, he's obviously a businessman and like running this like massively influential media platform. But I think he does also care about stuff like Cannes, right?
Does,
like
yeah.
He has a kind of like artsy kind of side to him. I remember last year at Cannes, I think it was our first day, we were sitting and I believe having a glass of rosé with Julie Miller, our colleague, and we were talking about the Netflix stuff. And you said something interesting. You said that Amazon wants to play the game, but Netflix wants to change the game. Mm-hmm. So what do you think Ted Sarandos' like vision is of that? Is it just a can that like lets anyone in, or like how does that function in his kind of
Yeah,
outlook?
I think he sees this sort of love affair with the theatrical release as kind of snobby and exclusive. And many of these movies that premiere at Cannes, their quote unquote theatrical release is like four theaters in New York and LA. It's just not, most people don't get to see them. Whereas his platform brings these art house movies or foreign language films to a huge potential audience. So I think he likes seeing movies in theaters too. He's a huge Orson Welles fan, which is why he financed this movie that nobody would finish for 40 years. But I also think he sees a snobbery in the traditional model and the way it really excludes people outside major cities.
Mm-hmm.
So, but is that really a reason to just be completely implacably obsessed with the idea of day and date? Like, it just seems sort of
unnecessarily stubborn. And Amazon has certainly found a way to make it work otherwise, although Amazon's business model is different. I mean, they just want to get you to subscribe to their service so that you then use it to buy other things,
right?
Whereas Netflix wants to get you to subscribe to their service to see their stuff, period, end of story.
Right. But if I think what seems to be missing from Ted Sarandos's analysis is that theatrical release is part of a marketing rhythm.
Right.
And the inability to see something in a way is
makes
part
cool.
of what makes people want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And when something just like pops up in your queue and then, you know, for whatever reason, you didn't look at it because you're actually just thinking like, I'm going to just watch another David Chang, and then it disappears from your queue like that. You know, it just, it's like there's something not working there, I
True.
Feel like.
Yeah. No, it doesn't give you, I don't think Netflix has yet created an event movie. You know, they've had some docs that you would see a lot of people watching at the same time, sort of talking about on social media. And it's also really hard to judge because they don't share their data. And so I have no idea, literally no idea, how many people watch these movies that they
yeah.
spend, you know, $5 million on, $10 million on. And I've talked to filmmakers who also don't get data. So it's
that's
really,
the really crazy part to me, that the
crazy.
Filmmakers never know who is watching. Like, cause, you know, the whole Netflix thing of engineering it for the audience. Like, if Noah Baumbach knows that he had a huge amount of people watch his movie in the Midwest, like, maybe that affects what he decides to make next.
I agree.
Well, I mean, guys, let's be fair. Some people do get to see the data. If you're Ryan Murphy and you're about to be given $300 million,
right.
then you get to see the data.
Well, and TV, yeah. by the way, I think for TV, like, it's an amazing model. It'll be
yeah.
interesting to see once Disney launches its streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, filmmakers will be able to be in business with a company that has this massive theatrical distribution model that they can offer. They're also going to have Fox Searchlight, who knows how to take art house movies out. I think that will create some problems for Netflix. I mean, there's still, even now, you know, agents, when you talk to agents about Netflix, they say, some of them, you know, I bring it to my clients as the take the money and run option. So that's, you just got a big mortgage, do a Netflix movie, you know, right. And I don't think that's what Netflix wants.
Well, and all the money, because all the money's up front, there's no back end, but there's also none of the risk that you would take on for that.
Right.
But now, and part of it is also the theatrical distributors, right, refusing to run these movies because you can watch them at home. And Sarandos's argument is presumably the same one that we went through in the magazine world in the past 10 years, which is like, cannibalization doesn't exist. Remember that argument?
Yeah. People just watch more.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think there is some evidence to suggest that. It's just where they're watching that's changed. But ultimately, people are spending more time consuming content. That disgusting word, content.
Right. Yeah.
The thing that continues to baffle me about Netflix, just really anecdotally, is someone who uses their service to watch documentaries and acclaimed TV series and Oscar nominees, is that when I go to the Netflix homepage, there's no effort whatsoever to show me any of that stuff. Like, I get the ad for the giant Adam Sandler movie that they spent the most of on the homepage, and I know how rigorously they engineer these things and, like, change the thumbnails for shows based on who they think you are. It feels like they don't care, and I feel like filmmakers must notice that, too.
I think your husband's just watching Adam Sandler movies late at night.
My first instinct was, Katie, it's time to talk to your husband about his Netflix viewing habits.
What is he watching after you go to bed?
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So we talked briefly about the Cannes jury and how we expect it to be very glamorous and starry. And so, Richard, you have been in Cannes enough and I think heard a lot of conversations about what the jury likes and what the head of the jury is trying to do. There's a sense that the juries on these things, they're not just picking things, but like who they are and their personalities have a ton of impact on things, at least at Cannes, right?
The two sort of things that I know anecdotally are that last year when Pedro Almodovar was the head of the jury, his favorite film, he sort of said post the announcement of The Square winning the Palme d'Or, he said his favorite film was BPM, Beats Per Minute, but that he felt that he needed to sort of be more, you know, magnanimous and sort of like letting having the kind of like be a consensus choice. So the impression I got was that The Square was no one's favorite movie, but everyone liked it enough, which is kind of like how maybe the tiered balloting system works with the Oscars. So you get that, but then you also get stories I heard from like a few years ago when Xavier Dolan was on the jury. He was not the head of the jury that year. It was the Coen brothers. There was reportedly some, you know, acrimony behind the scenes there where Dolan kind of like stonewalled everyone and said that this French actress had to share Best Actress with Rooney Mara or he like wouldn't leave the room or something like that. So, you know, and then at the press conference after, like, Dolan said something like, you know, I feel like I've grown a little bit or something like that. And one of the Coen brothers leaned into the microphone and said, don't worry, you didn't. Or something like, I think that it can get pretty contentious. And technically, I think the head of the Cannes jury can just like rule unilaterally and choose a winner. I don't think that like that's done often because, you know, it would be bad press or something. But it seems like an intense thing. And this year in particular, like with a major movie star as the president of the jury, there's going to be even that much more attention on what they choose. And, you know, it's interesting that it's Cate Blanchett, Kristen Stewart, Ava DuVernay, Lea Seydoux. The jury is a lot more better proportioned in terms of male female than the selection certainly is. So that'll be interesting, you know, especially considering what Jessica Chastain, a jury member last year, had to say about watching these movies about women that were not really actually about women, you know. So I think it's going to be all eyes on the jury this year.
I was sort of hopeful last year when it seemed like Terry Fermeau was listening to Jessica Chastain, yeah, talking about the sort of paucity of female voices at Cannes. And then this year's lineup suggests no, because it's like 14% female directors or something like that in competition. But I do, it is sort of heartening to know that Cate Blanchett is in charge of deciding what's good, because I can't think of anyone better qualified.
Yeah.
Can you imagine arguing with Cate Blanchett? Like, if she wants to unilaterally determine something,
no,
I'd be like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You'd just be like, you know, I probably have horrible taste. You're right.
Yes,
you're
my
right.
queen, yes. Yeah.
So we all have experience serving on film festival juries of ourselves, not with Cate Blanchett, I don't think. But, I mean, these are just people, right? Like, we think of, you know, a film festival winner as being kind of deigned from on high, but these arguments that you're talking about between, like, the Coen brothers, like, it feels like it proves the humanity of the people who are just trying to figure out what's best.
I think that was something that was interesting last year from Cannes, and I was on like a jury where I could watch everything at home pretty much, you know, on like screening links and stuff like that. But like Will Smith was on the jury at Cannes last year, and I think that he, and Chastain I think too, like these are not people who are necessarily used to seeing like 18 movies in the span of like a few days, you know? And so I think like a certain amount of like, I don't know, tiredness kind of comes into factor, mm-hmm, like coming into play, and like kind of maybe the last thing you saw is the best thing, or the first thing you saw was the best thing. So they are human beings. You can't always like divine, you know, higher intent out of what they choose, because sometimes it's just like, I was, you know.
Well, I think that's a good point too, is and then the aggregate of actually like sitting through 8 to 10 or to 18 movies in a short, yeah, period of time, I think it affects what you like a,
sure,
little bit, right?
Sure.
So when I did South by Southwest a few years ago, it was Oliver Platt, Kate Arthur from BuzzFeed, and myself. And we,
whoa,
sat,
that's
and
quite a room.
It was great. Oliver insisted that we all sit in the balcony so no one could like watch us react. I was like, no one knows who I am.
You get mobbed at South by Southwest,
I get it,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then he kept ordering us rounds of chocolate milkshakes the entire time. It was quite, I've had
that
a lot
is
of wonderful
actually really
chocolate
smart
milkshakes. And at the end of it, we gave the award to a film called Fort Tilden, which is like a pretty crazy comedy. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
Yeah,
thing.
From the people who made the show Search Party. Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, they went places. You guys made a good choice.
It was controversial at the time. People are like, what? You liked that movie?
Yeah.
But watching 8-9 movies in a row, we were like, this is the one with a creative spark. It's not a perfect movie, but this is the one where I'm like, holy shit, these people are talented and they're doing something different. And so like when Search Party became a thing, Kate Arthur DM'd me on Twitter and she's like, are you watching Search Party with the amount of pride that I am?
Oh,
we,
yeah,
felt like very vindicated. But it's just a different, you know, that,
yeah,
that like trying to figure out what's best. First of all, what does that even mean? What's best? You know, what are you looking for? I think that's where a jury president or the jury conversations are gonna, you're gonna start with questions like that. Like, what are we even trying to reward here?
Yeah.
You know, because you could go a lot of different directions.
The jury that I was on last year was New Fest, which is like an LGBTQ festival that's run in New York. And my category was international. So it was, we were watching, you know, gay themed movies from like India, where, you know, not a lot of gay movies are made. And but then also really a slick, you know, kind of Irish romantic comedy. So like the level of the filmmaking and the sort of budgets were so different that we had a lot of conversation when we were deliberating about like, okay, well, like obviously like this one is technically the best made, but which one like means more to like the country it's representing or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm,
so yeah, you're right, Mike, that it's not always just this kind of like easy, like, well, that's the best one done. Like there's a more to it, to the decision making, I think.
Yeah.
I start my Tribeca jury screenings tomorrow, and they sort of give you a schedule, and the titles were not familiar to me, and I decided that I would not do any research on them, which if I was covering them as a journalist, I would, you know, dig into them, find out about the filmmakers. And I just thought, you know what, I just want to go in and see it and have whatever, the closest thing you can have to sort of a pure reaction, and go from there.
I always prefer doing that at festivals in general. Yeah. You know, it's just, it's good to go in like totally cold. It's the only time when you can, you know, if by the time a movie comes out, you've been hit with the marketing and all the other stuff. But at a festival, sometimes you're just like, I don't know what this is going to be.
Right.
Let's find out.
Fingers crossed.
Oh, the Coen brothers directed it. I mean, literally, I've had that that level of ignorance, self-imposed ignorance.
The thing that you guys are making clear is that when you're on a film festival jury, like, you know, the world isn't going to remember who wins the Palme d'Or, much less the South by Southwest jury prize. But it matters so much to the filmmakers. Like, Mike, you help make Search Party happen. And, you know, Rebecca, you're going to like be seeking out talent at Tribeca. So it's a huge responsibility, because the people who you're deliberating on are going to know it and take it to heart so much.
Oh God. Now I'm thinking of the movies that shows that probably didn't get made because we were
look
like,
look at that. Eh. There's... genius that never happened. Yeah, they get, you know, I mean, the filmmakers, they get a laurel for their poster, which seems like a small thing. But when you're trying to market some teeny tiny movie, or maybe you're looking for distribution, that little laurel can be a difference maker. And it's certainly, most of these people who make festival movies have made them at great sacrifice. They've run up their credit card bills. They've alienated all their friends and family. And they show up and, like, you're their first audience. And you really do actually have the potential to have an impact on their career.
God.
Sorry. Now I made Mike feel really the weight of responsibility.
Sorry,
somebody
everybody.
Got divorced and went into foreclosure because you didn't pick them at South by Southwest.
But it might. I mean, think South by Southwest is wonderful. But I mean, think about that intensity for being on the Cannes jury. That's
yeah. Well, I think at Cannes, the movies, you know, they're higher profile movies probably than the ones we're seeing. So they come with more potential for distribution and whatnot. But yeah, at the festivals that we have been at, a lot of these movies are made just like blood, sweat, and tears.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why they pick people like Ava DuVernay with Nerves of Steel, who I don't think anything could flap her at this point. So
true.
She can make the tough decisions. Rebecca and Richard, you guys will be attending some Tribeca stuff in the coming days. Is there anything, like, a lot of these movies will be coming out in various ways throughout the year. Anything people should keep an eye out for if they're in New York or maybe that's coming down the pike?
I am going tonight, as we record, going to a movie with Sarah Jessica Parker where she plays, it's called Blue Night, where she plays a singer of some renown. I don't know how famous the singer's supposed to be, who's, I think, dying of a disease or something. So she's in it with Renee Zellweger and Common. So it's a kind of
a
weird lineup of actors. And, you know, Tribeca is kind of that festival. You're like, oh, so-and-so has a movie there. You know, it's a lot of strange kind of things. And so I haven't, like, necessarily heard any buzz about it, but I'm certainly curious about it. But Tribeca is mostly known these days as kind of a documentary, and they opened festival, and they opened with Love, Gilda, which, Rebecca, you saw.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is this documentary about Gilda Radner, and it's really sort of bittersweet. I mean, she had this tragic life, which I knew the broad outlines of, but which the doc gets into in great detail. They have her journals. They have unbelievable footage of her in childhood. And I mean, the footage of New York City in the 70s is so amazing. The city looks so dirty and beautiful, and everyone with their crazy hair and their big jeans. It just looks like a wonderful time to have been a creative person. But the movie, you know, I sort of went into it expecting it to be really funny because Gilda Radner was so funny. But I was moved to tears multiple times in it because of her life was really tragic, which was not what I was really expecting heading into that.
Yeah, yeah.
And Love, Gilda has distribution, right? That's coming out soon.
It's a CNN movie, actually.
Ah.
Oh, is it?
On the sort of biographical front, on Sunday I'm seeing a biopic of Robert Mapplethorpe, just called Mapplethorpe, and with Matt Smith from The Crown is playing the famed photographer.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and the after party is at a very intense gay nightclub, which
really
is interesting. It's going to be funny to see the Tribeca sort of film crowd at this place that I've seen in very different contexts, let's just say.
Well, I'm going to... So Matt Turnauer, former Vanity Fair editor, and who made Valentino and a lot of documentaries, has the Studio 54 documentary.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to see that next Tuesday. The after party's at the Museum of Sex.
That's
I was
right.
like,
yeah.
am I going to go to this?
New York in the 70s is having a really big...
It really is. Yeah. I blame sort of nostalgic Gen Xers, I think, who are just like, why were we too little to get in on all of
yeah.
this?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
And Richard, isn't Matt Smith playing Mapplethorpe in that movie?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, so Crown fans will have interest, you know, in that, I'm sure. Maybe Claire
I feel like
Foy
Prince Philip would not approve.
Claire Foy as Patti Smith. That would be...
There you go.
That would be wild.
When are they going to make the Just Kids movie? That's all this makes me...
Oh, seriously.
Yeah, I've been waiting for that for a long time.
Meanwhile, tonight I'm going to the sleeper called Scarface that maybe you've heard of.
Oh.
They're premiering the restoration of the film. Should be long and swear-filled, and there's a conversation afterward.
And the party's at a Coke den afterward, right?
Probably, yeah. I assume. Yeah, I have not yet gotten my invitation.
More 70s New York.
Yes, yeah, really just...
Say hello to my little friend.
Exactly.
Oh, Scarface, amazing.
Pacino's been having... he had a retrospective a couple months ago. It's big time. So we can look out for some coverage of Tribeca on VF.com. And Rebecca, I don't know how much you get to like tweet or share from your jury experience, but I'm dying to hear about all the blind item fights you have behind the scenes.
I don't know how much I'm allowed to tweet.
Who else is on the jury?
There's only three people on my jury. I'm in the jury for the Nora Ephron Prize. And one of them is an actress from Saturday Night Live. And I think the other one is a filmmaker. it's a good little group. And I don't think there will be a lot of, I suspect it will be pretty chill with only three people.
But not like Jacob Bernstein. It's not the writer.
No.
His son. Okay.
No.
Because then there could be some real drama.
Then there could be some serious drama.
The Nora Ephron Prize sounds like such a great thing to win. Like, I might rather have that than just about any other film festival prize there is.
It kind of does, doesn't it? Yeah.
So that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. You can find us all at vanityfair.com, writing about Tribeca and Cannes and all sorts of other things. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Mike.
Mike _ Hogan.
And Richard.
Rylaws.
And Rebecca.
At that Rebecca.
This episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth. And this week's award for the best description of Richard and Rebecca's Cannes experience goes to Rebecca Keegan.
They've run up their credit card bills. They've alienated all their friends and family.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.